ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan, on Gadigal Land.
And me, Tegan Taylor, also on Gadigal Land. Today, you might not know exactly what they do, but you've probably heard of PFAS, so-called forever chemicals, and you almost definitely have some in your home, Norman. I'm thinking things like stain protectors for fabrics, non-stick things.
Yeah, I sprayed some on my new suede boots recently.
Well, they're in water sources around the world as well at higher concentrations than we thought. So the question is, do they have health harms?
Very timely, since the US Environmental Protection Agency has set new limits for PFAS compounds.
And you're looking at cancer treatment.
Yep, for a commonly neglected cancer, bladder cancer, ninth commonest cancer and often missed.
I do want to start with health news, the way we have been doing in general these days. There is one really big health story that I want to devote a lot of attention to today, and we're going to do that in a minute. It's about big review of puberty blockers for young kids who think they could be transgender. We'll dig into that really soon. But first, some news about urinary tract infections, awful things, and some people are unlucky enough to have recurring UTIs. And there's a study that's looked into whether an oral spray could be enough to ward them off.
Yes. So what we're talking about here is basically cystitis, and there'll be lots of people listening who've had it.
Subconsciously clenching their legs
whatever,
together.
Yeah, peeing razor blades is the common expression. Now, it's much more common in women than men, but what we're not good at is understanding why some people get recurrent cystitis. Is it because the surface in their bladder is more sticky to bacteria? Has an initial episode of cystitis caused damage, and therefore the next time you get bacteria in there, they're more likely to stick? Some people suspect that it may be possible your partner is reinfecting you. Mm-hmm. So this is not because your partner has been disloyal to you or cheating on you. It could mean that they've got something like chronic prostatitis and they actually are passing on their infection too. So men have been under-investigated as a cause of the woman's cystitis. I'll just put that out there. So what this is a sublingual spray. So it goes under the tongue and it contains a cocktail of bacteria, killed bacteria, not live bacteria, which is the range of bacteria that commonly cause cystitis.
So it's a vaccine, but it's not injected.
Kind of a vaccine, yes. Well, essentially it is a vaccine, yes, but it's not injected. It's under the tongue. Now, the advantage of it being under the tongue is it doesn't go to the liver. It bypasses the liver and goes straight into the bloodstream.
Oh.
Anything that you swallow goes into the stomach, goes to the liver, and the liver acts on that and can break it down or can turn it into something else. But if you take it under the tongue, it goes straight into the bloodstream. So that's the idea in this sublingual vaccine.
Why would you not inject it?
Well, because you've got to take it daily to get an effect. So this is it's more like a drug. So this is a daily sublingual vaccine that they've trialed. Now, word of warning, the trials have been funded by the drug company.
Yeah.
So drug company trials tend to find positive results. However, so there's been one trial, a randomized trial, which showed that they reduce the rate of infections by about a half compared to placebo. So 25% of women were not getting repeat infections compared to 56% in the placebo group. And then there's now a conference abstract suggesting they've taken this further and followed people through for many years looking at safety and effectiveness. And it does look, again, we've not seen any detail on the research from this abstract, that it may well be safe and effective. But they're smallish studies and they are sponsored by the drug company or the company that produces the vaccine. But if it works, a boon for women and you're not getting antibiotic resistance.
So another question that we get a lot through our other podcast, What's That Rash? And just anecdotally is whether there's like an ideal time of day to exercise. And a new study has just come out showing that maybe there is.
Yeah, so this is a study of people with heart disease, vascular disease, in other words, arterial disease, obesity and type 2 diabetes, and finding that the mortality reduction of exercise was greatest when they took exercise in the evening. And there wasn't really a good explanation of that. So there was a mortality benefit. In other words, taking exercise was good for you no matter when you did it, a bit better in the evening. As you say, we're getting questions about this all the time, particularly for What's That Rash? And I've been looking at this, and there's mixed evidence about time of day and exercise in normal, healthy people. And, for example, they've looked at growth hormone, which helps build up your body. No difference in growth hormone, as far as I can see, in terms of time of day. Cortisol, which is a measure of, if you like, physical stress from exercise, not a bad thing. It's greatest in the morning, suggesting you're putting your body under more metabolic stress in the morning. And that's actually one of the reasons you exercise, is to put your body under metabolic stress.
Because that's it's a good one.
Good thing. But lactic acid, which is what you produce with anaerobic exercise when you're doing muscle strengthening, and the ability to take up oxygen in your lungs, which is a measure of fitness, no difference with time of day. So bottom line here, just take your exercise when it suits you.
Right, because I'm a morning exerciser in general. I'm not going to die earlier because I haven't exercised at night.
No, you're not. Better doing your exercise at the time of day that suits you, because that's the time of day that you're going to do the exercise.
And we did promise just before, Norman, to come into one of the biggest health news stories from this week, which is about a big review in the UK into the evidence around gender-affirming care for kids who are experience gender dysphoria, whether hormone treatments are appropriate there. And it's something that we really want to devote a bit of time to today.
Yes, it's been enormously controversial. Some people listening might remember the Four Corners that Patricia Karvelas did a little while ago on this. So it's become political, it's become ideological, and it's hugely controversial in the United Kingdom, because the United Kingdom's only had one clinic at the Tavistock, which has had a huge international reputation for other things in psychiatry and mental health. But in this case, highly controversial in terms of their approach to kids who have gender identity issues, and it's affecting their lives, causing them psychological distress. That's really what we mean with gender dysphoria. So it was so controversial in terms of what was happening in the Tavistock. By the way, they've banned puberty blockers. Well, they haven't banned them, but the advice on evidence-based medicine is not to give them in the United Kingdom. But as part of a review by a paediatrician called Hilary Cass into this whole area, which started several years ago and went through COVID, a group at the University of York reviewed the evidence that they could get from around the world to see what benefits there were. Now, I'm going to come back to that review of the evidence, but I thought it was important before we go on to look at this fraught area, is that we talk to a psychiatrist who actually specialises in young people's psychiatry and the complexity of kids who come forward with gender dysphoria and how they deal with it. And I spoke to Associate Professor Elizabeth Scott, who's a psychiatrist who leads the Youth Mental Health Research Team at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre.
There's a very small proportion of young people, mostly boys, who have identity issues really from a very early age and express behaviours which are consistent with the opposite sex and then go on to develop significant gender dysphoria. So they literally say that they feel trapped in the wrong body, and that's distressing for them and their parents. And those are the young people who in the UK report have been assessed for puberty blockers. What we've seen in practice in Australia is really an increase in a different group of young people after puberty. That is the larger group that I see. And there certainly have been increasing numbers of adolescents, particularly girls, presenting with mental health problems who also identify problems and issues with their gender identity. So we're talking about different groups of people, and they require different kinds of care. And in Australia, we've actually been very good at setting up the holistic care for this kind of second larger group of young people through this kind of network of youth mental health centres, particularly the Headspace sites around the country.
So you're saying that, say, under the age of 10 or just as puberty is coming on, this is an issue around boys. You're not seeing young girls. They're not coming forward when they're young to say, I'm trapped in the wrong body.
No. So traditionally, this has been more a problem identified in boys. Obviously, we're now much more aware of this issue. So more young people are, and parents and families are coming forward. But essentially, they're a relatively small proportion of the population. These children usually express those behaviours from very early ages. They're very consistent. And as they approach puberty, become very distressed about the potential change in their bodies, which they feel are not consistent with the way they feel about themselves. And it requires really multidisciplinary care of the types of clinics that we see in Melbourne and in Westmead Hospital in Sydney and in Western Australia in the kind of Perth clinic.
So what's the story with these young women coming forward with their gender issues?
I think it reflects a lot more awareness of the gender fluidity that we see with different developmental stages. So obviously early adolescence, mid-adolescence is a time when young people are really trying to find their identity. That includes their kind of sexual identity, their gender identity. And I think it reflects the fact that these are very fluid, particularly in women. And we've always known that in females have much higher levels of gender fluidity. And I think our community allows young people to express themselves.
So what you're saying is that gender fluidity is nothing new. We're just seeing it.
No.
It's just being revealed. Just give me a sense of the complexity you see as a psychiatrist of young people.
A proportion of these young people have had pre-existing mental health issues or they are neurodiverse. So some would fall within the autistic spectrum, who are really struggling to find a place in their school or their community. So a lot of them have developed quite significant social anxiety. They become socially disconnected. They have very poor self-esteem. They often have a lot of self-hatred. They've developed significant symptoms of depression. They often are quite isolated within their community, find it hard to discuss these things with their parents. And it often takes quite a long time to tease out these issues, to understand exactly where the young person sits, what some of the pre-existing developmental factors are, what the external family and social factors are, to try and understand how this has arisen in the context for this young person, and then to identify what are the best path forward for them. We do see young people who are trying to understand these issues. A lot of them settle into a kind of an idea that they're non-binary. They don't necessarily fit into either of our more polarized masculine and feminine role, gender-based stereotypes. That they can be non-binary and they can sit within that. And there is now a much wider acceptance in the youth community and understanding of that. So it is acceptable and young people can obviously become comfortable with that. There's a huge amount of media information that gets fed to young people, which I think is very confusing often. It's certainly confusing for parents. And I think that contributes to young people finding it hard to navigate adolescence. So our job in mental health is to provide inclusive, supportive, welcoming environments that include families to try and help young people navigate these difficult areas. We still have problems with access to care in Australia, even though we do better than the UK. UK have very long waiting lists. So again, we need to invest more in these key developmental transition periods for young people.
So from your experience of particularly young women who are coming forward with psychological distress, what's their track through the next 10 years of their life?
We see very serious issues around mental health and also rates of suicide and self-harm in young people who are trying to transition, for instance. When you follow people up over time, people are less distressed if they get good care, particularly holistic care. I certainly see young people who have gone through puberty with serious gender dysphoria and really to struggle to cope as adults with a body which they do not feel they belong in. So I think there are major harms in not providing appropriate care for young people in ways that are acceptable to them. We could definitely do better with families. Families tend to get left out.
Associate Professor Elizabeth Scott is a psychiatrist who leads the Youth Mental Health Research Team at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. In the studio with me is Professor Ian Hickey, also from the Brain and Mind Centre, who's the Co-Director of Health and Policy at the centre. Welcome, Ian.
Good afternoon, Norman.
So coming back to the original point of this story, is the reason we're doing it is that published in, I think, the Archives of Diseases of Childhood this week are two reviews commissioned by this CAS review of gender identity services in the United Kingdom. They're a little bit old, they're a couple of years old, and one is looking at the evidence for puberty blockers and what effects they have on kids and whether they've got benefits, and also hormones. And when we're talking about hormones, we're talking about masculinizing or feminizing hormones in older adolescents who've gone through puberty. And they said in this review that they could not prove benefit. Maybe a little bit of mental health benefit in hormone therapy in kids going through puberty. What's your response to these reviews?
Well, you make the important point there's a series of reviews that have been commissioned and now eventually been published. One's around clinical guidelines. What are the clinical guidelines based on? Which is, that's important because that's the basis of clinical practice.
Now, we should do a little bit of context here because it actually wasn't fully covered in the Four Corners, which is what went on at the Tavistock. Because it was the only service in England for these kids.
What went really wrong in the UK is so UK. long waiting lists, hard to get care, and then one clinic taking one narrow approach to care. So within Tavistock, which is a child psychiatry clinic, it wasn't simply gender affirming, it simply prioritised access to medical treatments over psychological treatments, over comprehensive assessment of the type that Elizabeth Scott was just describing. And people who worked in that, who had a mental health background, said, hang on, this isn't okay. We're supposed to be a mental health clinic providing holistic care, and yet we're pushing people preferentially only down a medical pathway. So that led to, quite rightly, this is not optimal care. That in turn led to reviews, well, what's the evidence for the whole of what's called gender-affirming care? Now, we need to break that down because that's got several important different components. The gender-affirming bit does not inevitably mean that you go to puberty blocking. It does not inevitably mean that you go to providing sex hormones or that you go in later adolescence to surgery or to interference in various ways of reconstructing the body. It simply means you provide a safe and welcoming environment for kids at different stages who are struggling with these issues, and you do that in a way that will encourage them and their families to discuss the issues. Now, it's really important to say...
So if they've got psychological distress, you treat that?
You treat the lot. You're going to have psychological distress. You have medical possibilities. You have multidisciplinary teams. You have paediatricians, as you once were, Norman, endocrinologists, medical people, psychiatrists, child psychologists, others, considering the whole of the situation for this particular child and be in active dialogue with the child at their age and their parents about what are the options. Wait, start a particular psychological treatment, consider medical treatments, review what you're doing continuously in highly specialised, continuing ways. And we're very lucky in Australia. The main clinics here in Melbourne, in Perth, elsewhere in Brisbane, have done that since day one. The Tavistock did not do it. And that's been the source of the biggest, you know,
so the critics here have relied on the headlines around the Tavistock rather than what we're actually doing.
Yes, and they've not really taken into account what the situation is in Australia. And unfortunately, this has been politicised. Prime ministers in the United Kingdom, presidential candidates in the United States buying into the polarisation of gender politics and using this as the issue, which is frankly ridiculous. We've been very fortunate here in Australia that health ministers and others have stayed out of it, despite calls in the media that the Prime Minister should respond, to say, hang on a second. Where they've finally got to in the UK, holistic care, we should have appropriate clinics, we should look at these things, and we should have good longitudinal research, is where we've been in Australia for the last 10 years.
So speaking of longitudinal research, I mean, on the health report, we preferentially cover just this kind of analysis, which is a systematic review where you bring the evidence together. And they say, well, they can't show psychological benefits, at least for puberty blockers, maybe for hormone treatment.
Now, you've got to unpack now systematic reviews. Okay, so systematic reviews are these evidence synthesis tools. Great for cancer, great for cardiology, lots of randomised controlled trials, lots of big longitudinal studies, big databases of the highest level of evidence. However, most areas of medicine, certainly areas of most mental health, paediatrics, obstetrics, many areas of health, don't have large RCTs. Can you imagine trying to establish a randomised controlled trial of puberty blockers? It's not possible nor ethical. A simple comparator. So this review says, oh, look, now absence of RCTs. Lack of comparator studies. What's the comparator? Who needs to be looked at?
So what's the control group?
What's the control group? So then they said, oh, well, the quality of evidence in all of the studies that have been done, quite a lot of studies, is of moderate or low quality. You go, hang on a second. Compared to what? And on the basis of what could we form the best clinical guidelines? And we have clinical guidelines for all sorts of conditions in medicine using exactly these levels of evidence to best inform us what to do today. I think the important point the reviews make is the need to ensure that we continue to have good longitudinal evidence of what actually happens to kids psychologically, social function, health outcomes, neuropsychologically, not just a year later, but 5 years later, 10 years later, what will happen? Some of the best longitudinal evidence on some key issues comes from Australia. From Western Australia. And thank God for our Western Australian colleagues, because they've got one of the best articles to come out ever in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Paediatrics about the issue about do kids change their mind? They want to go backwards, which parents and everyone really worries about. Over 500 kids they looked at long term, less than 5% ever changed their mind. And they changed their mind early, mostly. Of those who went on to puberty blockers or in the early stages, only 2 ever changed their mind. And they did that fairly early on. So that big concern that there's a huge number who will want to be something different later on is not supported by the longitudinal evidence. A big clinical concern, that one. The other ones on what happens to the mental health outcomes. Well, you talk about very young kids and their psychological distress, and they quite rightly say we're unsure at this stage. As Liz Scott just pointed out, we know for the older kids in puberty and adolescence, the rates of suicidal ideation, mental health problems are high. If you go to one of the other reviews, which is about the hormones, giving the male hormones or the female hormones to the opposite sex, then they said, oh, interestingly, the pre-post studies there do show a benefit on mental health outcomes in that particular group, the group that we're seeing very commonly in the youth area now. But they're not randomised controlled trials. They're not large numbers of comparative studies. I must say, in Australia, we're also very fortunate. We now have much more longitudinal research going on in broader frameworks. So Headspace in Australia, which is what the UK would be desperate to have, about 30% of the kids that come along to those clinics are same-sex attracted. We've created a space that is safe to say you're same-sex attracted. And about 3% are actually in this non-binary group. We have actually created the thing the UK now yearns for in Australia. Now we need to connect that with good longitudinal studies.
So what you're saying is it's a mixed group. So some are coming with dilemmas over their sexual orientation, some over their gender identity, and you've got to unpick all that.
And they've got neurodevelopmental diversity, they've got other sets of issues. What you don't want is any clinic that has a predetermined idea. We've had psychiatric clinics that have said it's all due to a traumatic family life. It's all, as you know, Norman, famously in psychiatry, we've always said it's a mum's fault. We've made accusations about the nature of families. We've pathologised things which were not pathological. We've got a terrible history
of that.
And
that's why we've excluded families from the therapy.
That's why we've excluded families. That's why we blame families. On the other side of the coin, you don't want to end up in the Tavistock situation of saying there's only a medical road to go down. The individual case variation is high. We are fortunate in Australia we've arrived, but we do need to continue to do, and it's very important to say in Australia, the Medical Research Future Fund has just funded for $5 million, a very large national registry cooperation between our major hospitals so that we in Australia can look seriously. And the people involved in this in Australia, we're very fortunate, are really serious people who work in multidisciplinary teams to do exactly that, and they publish their outcomes.
And finally, are we getting any demand from the kids themselves? Are they, you know, from TikTok and from social media, are they coming in saying, I want puberty blockers, even in a pre-pubertal child, or I want masculinizing and feminizing hormones, and that's all I want, that's all I'm interested in.
This idea that kids rule the world, that 12-year-olds are demanding from their doctor, give me the hormones without, you know, is unrealistic. What is much more contentious is in 15 and 16-year-olds and 17 and 18-year-olds who are much more informed, wanting to make decisions about their own bodies and their own choices, and knowing that there are a range of options. They don't have to live the simple binary lives that perhaps you and I have had to live, Norman, and in the past and in other societies, they have options. As Liz said, most actually choose simply to be non-binary. A very small number really want to transition. And now we have a society that recognises them. Think we have a US president at the moment that recognises that trans people are people. So social views have moved on and now people are expressing that. But what we need is really good individual assessment, presentation of the real options and the real dangers or what may be lost if you go down certain paths.
And in an area where we're grossly under-resourced.
And the biggest struggle, of course, is the lack of child mental health and other services to sit alongside the teaching hospital medical services so that everyone does get appropriate comprehensive care.
Ian, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Norman.
Professor Ian Hickey, who is co-director of health and policy at the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney.
You've probably heard of PFAS chemicals. They're sometimes called century chemicals or forever chemicals. But Norman, do you remember what PFAS actually stands for?
Well, I'm cheating because I knew this was coming up. So I did swat it. Per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances.
I'm glad that you said it and I didn't have to because it's a bit of a mouthful. It's a funny kind of long technical term and it's an acronym that you've heard but maybe don't realise just how common they are.
4,700 of them were thereabouts.
You really have been sweating up. They're everywhere. They're used in firefighting foams and big commercial applications, but they're also in our houses and on our clothes, and they're really useful for making things resistant to stains and water and that kind of thing.
Classically Teflon and Scotchgard.
Correct. And so one of the reasons why they're good at this is because they're really stable molecules. And one of the downsides of them being really stable is that they can persist in the environment without breaking down and then accumulate within our bodies as we consume water and eat food from different ecosystems and food chains.
Breathe in dust, children crawling on carpets.
That's right. And so the big question mark is around their effects on our health. There's research that has linked them to health effects. There's other research that hasn't found much in the way of health effects. Either way, people are concerned about them. A new study has looked at the concentrations in water around the world and found that the concentrations are much higher than we realised. I've been speaking to the lead author of that study, Dennis O'Carroll from UNSW.
So we looked at groundwaters and surface waters around the world and compared PFAS concentrations in those waters to international drinking water standards and found that a large fraction are above drinking water regulations.
How did Australia compare to other countries that you looked at?
Australia would be normal in terms of exceedance. There do have a significant number of exceedances in Australia as well, particularly at locations where there was historic firefighting training activities, where we would have put a lot of foam on the ground and that would have seeped into our groundwaters or gone into our surface waters.
Why is it a problem if water is going to be treated anyway?
Historically, we didn't think about treating drinking water for PFAS. And PFAS, we want to remove it to very, very low levels. So some treatment plants wouldn't be designed to remove PFAS.
So what more do we need to be doing here?
Well, we need to, you know, sort of the other ones, we need to figure out, are they in our waters? We need to develop methods to detect them. We also need to get a sense of their toxicity, ecotoxicity, of the broader range as well. And also, we have to develop cheap methods to break apart these molecules when they do get into our source waters and we want to treat them.
Here in Australia, there are regulations around maximum concentrations in different types of water, recreational water, drinking water, and that sort of thing. Are those regulations enough?
I'm not an epidemiologist, so it's hard for me to say they're enough. The US EPA just came out regulating 6 PFAS to much lower levels than we do in Australia. And Health Canada and the European Union also would have much more comprehensive and stringent PFAS drinking water regulations or guidelines.
So as you mentioned before, water isn't the only source by any means of PFAS chemicals. They're in clothing, other household items, cooking items. How does the concentration that you've found in water compare to the other exposure that people have just throughout their lives?
Well, that's a great point. And drinking water isn't the only exposure. It's an important fraction, but not the only fraction. So there's a wide range of contexts, as you suggest. Also, if it was in food wrapping historically, that would have been a form of ingestion as well.
What do you hope comes out of this study?
Well, I just hope there's more awareness. And I guess as a society, I hope we consider not just PFAS, but the broad range of chemicals that we use in the environment. Just because we can use a chemical doesn't mean we should use a chemical. So we should give some due consideration and try to lower our environmental burden such that, you know, in another 10, 20 years, we're not looking at some other plastic chemical and saying, oh, we should have done something sooner.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
Thanks. Have a good day.
So that's Dennis O'Carroll. He's a professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of New South Wales. And that's very much an engineering study. It's good to know concentrations out there. The question, I think, Norman, is what we actually know about the health effects of PFAS.
Well, it's not for want of looking. So there has been quite a lot of research in this area. Probably the best research comes out of the United States where they've looked at it. And an interesting review, and we'll have a link to that review on the Health Report's website. They reckon that there's a difference between species of how sensitive you are to
species.
Species. So rats and mice are the most sensitive that they found.
Oh, I thought you meant types of PFAS. I see what you're saying. Okay.
No, species of aminals. Species of aminals. And so rats and mice are highly sensitive to PFAS. Guinea pigs, non-human primates and humans are much less sensitive. Doesn't mean to say they don't experience harm. Now, when you talk about chemical toxicity, it's hard to really go down to our level where we are exposed to it, like my nice suede Chelsea boots that I'm now feeling guilty that I sprayed.
They're very stylish.
That sort of exposure. If you've got a serious chemical issue, it's usually people who are most exposed. So
sort of occupational exposure.
They're the highest, or residents nearby where their groundwater might be contaminated, which was that Four Corners that was done a few years ago. It's even with occupational exposure, it's hard to determine harm. The indications are from this review, and they only looked at 10 PFAS, the commonest ones, and there was indications, not cause and effect, indications that preeclampsia in women in pregnancy, so raised blood pressure, swollen ankles, indications that there may be an association there. Liver enzymes going up. So these are the enzymes that go up when you've had a binge of alcohol, where you've got liver damage, your liver enzymes go up. It's not necessarily a sign of permanent damage, but liver enzymes go up.
Is it a sign that maybe your liver's working hard to clear something that it's recognising as not being good?
That's absolutely right. effects on, again, not easy to explain, on blood lipids, blood fats, a reduced antibody response to vaccines, slightly reduced birth weights, and possible carcinogenic effects. So the International Agency for Research into Cancer, which defines carcinogens, classifies them as, I think, 2B, which is possible carcinogens, particularly of the urinary tract. We're going to come back to that in a minute, the urinary tract, which is not a great surprise, since if these are excreted by the kidneys and collected by the bladder, they could be causes of cancer. The point is, they're ubiquitous. They last for 20, 90 years. It depends on which PFAS you're talking about. They're there for a long time and they accumulate. And therefore, you've got to be pretty sure that they're safe. And so far, there may be a signal that they're not. And so there's this precautionary principle in public health, where if you don't know and there's no harm in removing these chemicals, then remove them. Although, you know, there is a problem with firefighting. There is a problem replacing this with textile protection and so on. This is not an easy area.
Mm. One of the things when I was reading up about this was the fact that when certain chemicals become maybe under question, manufacturers are then replacing them with other chemicals with similar properties, different chemical. That's why looking at them as a whole is important too.
Correct. So there were two banned ones, and particularly in the United States, and then they were, you're absolutely right, they were replaced, and people are saying the signals are similar.
Yeah, one we'll have to continue to watch. You're listening to The Health Report. So, Norman, you said before that we would talk again about the urinary tract. We talked about UTIs before. You talked about PFAS chemicals and their potential, maybe theoretical, link to cancers of the urinary tract. And now let's talk specifically about bladder cancer.
Yeah, it's the ninth commonest cancer. The risk factors for it are being male, but women can get bladder cancer too. Smoking, environmental toxins, which we're talking about, maybe alcohol, beer has been associated with it. As I said, toxins that are excreted in the urine, chronic infections. Best research is done into parasitic infections in low-income countries like schistosomiasis. But in men, the death rate from bladder cancer is similar to melanoma.
Right.
But it's treatable and curable if it's caught early. So before we get on to the treatment, which is what we're going to talk about in this story, is if anybody listening has blood in the urine, even once, and it doesn't come back again, get your GP to refer you to a urologist. Even when the GP does the dipstick and there's no blood in your urine, get referred to a urologist, because you almost certainly need a cystoscopy just to check. Blood in your urine, talk to your GP. Now, when you've got bladder cancer, the treatments are not easy. But the interesting thing with bladder cancers is that they seem to stimulate the immune system in a similar way to melanoma. There's a few tumours that seem to be more immune sensitive. One of the treatments they've been trying in bladder cancer, which is advanced, bladder cancer that's not advanced, you can simply remove it the way you would remove a polyp, but sometimes it's gone through the surface and you've got to treat it. And they are trying immunotherapy, which is these checkpoint inhibitors that release the immune system onto the tumour. And what Dickon Hayne, who's professor of urology at the University of Western Australia, has been seeing is whether they work better and are safe if injected directly into the tumour.
I think the important thing was that we showed that it was completely feasible and very safe. So these checkpoint inhibitor drugs or these immune therapeutic drugs, they can have some very serious side effects. And so anything to reduce the dose may reduce the chances of getting those sorts of severe reactions. And obviously, if the disease itself is just in the bladder, you wouldn't really want to give the drug to the whole of the body just to treat the bladder if that's avoidable.
Apart from safe, did you see regression of the tumours?
The way the study was designed, we were really just trying to get up to a target of dose that we could give into the bladder. But what we did see was we took biopsies before and after injecting the drug, and we did see that the immune system was stimulated by the injection of the checkpoint inhibitor, which is something called durvalumab in this case. And we did see some response to that. So it definitely has an immune effect. But what we didn't see was any systemic, as in immune-related side effects that affected the whole patient. So that was encouraging.
So that's promising to move forward there as a new form of treatment. Where are we at with the BCG, which is an immune stimulant originally used to protect against tuberculosis, but also used during COVID to see if it would help protect people against COVID before there was a vaccine? Where are we at with that and bladder cancer?
through ANZUP, which is a urogenital cancer trials group, we've been now completed recruiting to a very major study called the BCG plus mitomycin study, where we were comparing BCG into the bladder to treat bladder cancer with the addition of chemotherapy and the BCG. Other than it may be more effective in terms of treating the cancer, another major advantage is it uses far less BCG. In fact, if the trial proves to be positive or even equivalent, so if the combination of BCG and the chemotherapy is the same as BCG on its own, if that was rolled out globally, there'd be enough BCG to go around.
And finally, do we know why bladder cancer is more susceptible to immune treatments than others?
Look, I'm not sure that it is. The immune therapeutics, the checkpoint inhibitors, are very, very active in all sorts of different cancers. You know, we have only certain things we can do with cancer. We can either cut it out, we can poison it with chemotherapy or irradiate it. But there is something enticing about being able to rev up the immune system so that your own immune system fights the cancer as well. Probably to really defeat most cancers, we need to use one, two, or even all of these modalities to try and get rid of the disease.
So you're gearing up for a larger study then with the immunotherapy and injections?
We certainly hope to do the next stage, which we'll be giving this repeatedly to patients with bladder cancer. But at the moment, we haven't secured the funding for that.
Dickon, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Norman. Thank you.
That's Dickon Hayne, who's Professor of Urology at the University of Western Australia.
And that's it for the Health Report podcast for this week, Norman. But if people just can't get enough of you and me talking health to each other, they can, of course, check out What's That Rash?
Yep. It's where we answer your health and well-being questions. We do it absolutely seriously with no jokes, nothing at all. You know, just straight down the line.
Oh, you know us.
Yeah. So if you want something that doesn't take it too seriously but gives you the facts, What's That Rash is essential listening. We cover all sorts of things, including...
Pre-workout this week. I have done a deep dive. I have tasted and potentially snorted some sort of watermelon monstrosity.
Yeah. And in previous episodes, we've done things like wisdom teeth. What are they and what are the implications of having them out? So things that you've thought about and wonder what the answers are. We've got them and we'll have them on What's That Rash.
So find it wherever you get your podcasts, preferably the ABC Listen app, and make sure you hit follow so you never miss an episode.
Meantime, we'll see you next week.
See you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.